Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Today I'm speaking with Rory Stewart. Rory has written for the New York Times Magazine, Granta, and the London Review of Books. As you'll hear, he spent over a year walking across Iran, Pakistan, India, and Nepal. And he also walked across Afghanistan in 2002 after the fall of the Taliban. He describes that last part of the journey in his book, The Places in Between. And he has also run, however unsuccessfully, for Prime Minister in the UK. And his latest book, titled How Not to Be a Politician, describes that. Rory is a former fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. And he was awarded the Order of the British Empire by the British government for services in Iraq. He now lives in Scotland, and he runs a quite wonderful charity, which is Give Directly, which we discuss at the end of this episode. Give Directly is one of the favorite charities of GiveWell, which many people consider the most objective evaluator of charities, and it is a charity I support, and I hope you will as well. Rory is a fascinating person, and it is certainly nice to see someone who knows so much about the world running a charity of this kind. Today we speak about the fraying world order. We discuss the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the problems with nation building, the problem of our cultural ignorance when trying to build nations, tolerance for corruption, our catastrophic withdrawal from Afghanistan, the role that Islam played in our failures in Afghanistan and Iraq, conspiracy thinking, the influence of social media, cults of martyrdom, the war in Ukraine, the age of populism, Trump and the future of NATO, Brexit, the current state of politics, and finally the work he is doing at Give Directly. Apologies for my voice. I was still fighting a cold or whatever it was, but I am now recovered. And now I bring you Rory Stewart. I am here with Rory Stewart. Rory, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I am a fan of your work. I remember your, I don't know if it was your first book or not, The Places in Between, but I read that some time ago when it came out, and your new book or newish book is How Not to Be a Politician, which covers very different terrain, but is no less interesting. Let's just start with your background here, because it is fascinating and just so unconventional. How would you describe your career so far? And we're going to take it in pieces. I do want to take you back to Afghanistan to start. So yeah, please tell people who you are.
Well, thank you, Sam. So I'm British. I was born in Hong Kong and grew up in Malaysia. I joined the British Army when I was 18. Served very briefly, and then I went to Oxford University, and then I was moved into the British Foreign Service, the equivalent to the State Department, and I served in Indonesia, I served in Yugoslavia, just as the time of the Kosovo War. And then I took 2 years off to walk across Asia. So I walked across, well, from Turkey across Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and Nepal. I walked for about 21 months. I walked 25, 30 miles a day, stayed in a different village house every night. So I think I stayed in 550 different village houses on the walk. And then I returned and was posted to Iraq, where I was made the acting governor of a province in southern Iraq after the US invasion. And then I became a professor at Harvard. And then I became a British politician and a cabinet minister. And I ran to be prime minister against Boris Johnson and was defeated. And I now work with a nonprofit called Give Directly, and I'm also a professor at Yale.
Mm. Yeah, as I said, it's a thrilling bio. There are no doubt many adventures lurking under those several sentences. Let's talk about where I'll tell you where I want to take this. I want to talk about the state of our world and the erosion of what, again, I'm going to take this somewhat from an American perspective here, but there seems to be a quickly eroding commitment to maintaining the what is often described as the liberal world order, or the rules-based international order, or the Pax Americana, or whatever you want to call it. You know, as for more or less as long as I've been alive, there's been this expectation that America and Britain and other allies will keep the chaos at bay, you know, post-World War II. It's not to say we haven't had significant misadventures, obviously, but there's a new mood in America, and I'm sure there are populist analogs in Europe at the moment, which suggests that all of that was a fool's errand, and we should be retreating within our borders. We should, in the American case, aspire to be something like a nuclear-armed Switzerland, which you just get out of the world's business and leave people to their own devices. And so, you know, you have seen so much of our dashed hopes in foreign lands. I mean, so you have seen what, because many of these lessons for this new kind of realism seem to have been learned in Iraq and Afghanistan from an American perspective. So I want to talk about how things look in 2024, but perhaps we can start with our failure in Afghanistan and Iraq. What was your view of each of these wars when we went in? And perhaps you can talk about how or whether your view changed, and then take me up to our exit from both of those conflicts.
Well, Sam, I guess I you know, I'm just a little bit younger than you. We're a very similar age. And I've lived through these changes very dramatically. So just to frame it before I get into Iraq and Afghanistan. When I started as a young soldier at the beginning of the 90s, I was very much part of this world after the end of the Cold War. And the 90s and early 2000s felt like a time of real kind of triumph of the liberal world order. Remember, that was a period, 88 to 2004, the number of democracies in the world doubles. Every year, the world's getting more peaceful. There are fewer refugees. I served in the Balkans just after Bosnia and the Kosovo campaigns. And those interventions seemed to be extraordinarily successful in stopping wars, in bringing war criminals to trial, and demobilizing militia. So I came into Iraq and Afghanistan at the beginning of the 2000s. Yes, yeah, I guess because I'd been on the ground in places like Indonesia and in the Balkans, I thought realistic, but not realistic enough. I remember saying to friends before we went into Iraq, yeah, it's sure we're going to create a messy, corrupt, incompetent government, but it's got to be better than Saddam Hussein. I mean, I thought that was setting the bar pretty low.
Mm.
And again, in Afghanistan, it didn't seem to me to be inconceivable that we could create a state that was, or support the creation of a state that was better than what the Taliban had created. So fast forward, I served in Iraq, trying to govern this province, and as you can imagine, very, very quickly found out how profoundly unpopular our project was. I was in southern Iraq.
Just people to be clear, Rory, when you say you served in Iraq, this is in a political capacity, not as a soldier, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I was the acting governor of a province, first of 1 million people and then of 2 million people. So Misan and Dikar in the south. And I was responsible initially on my own and then with an American boss for holding small district elections, setting up a police force, trying to create employment schemes, building clinics, getting electricity off the ground, trying to mediate between different tribal groups. And it was a very kind of colonial situation, which had been created by Paul Bremer under George W. Bush, who didn't want to hold elections too soon and thought that the US and the UK and other allies could basically try to run Iraq. What I discovered, of course, is that Iraqis were grateful that Saddam Hussein had gone and that we'd got rid of Saddam, but were very troubled and upset at the idea of somebody who wasn't a Muslim, wasn't an Iraqi, and was a 30-year-old guy trying to run their affairs.
Do you remember what your opinion was of our initial invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq after 9/11? I mean, just to remind listeners of what I was thinking. I going into Afghanistan seemed obviously warranted and even necessary. Obviously we made some terrible mistakes in how we tried to deal with Al-Qaeda initially. And the project of nation building there, which I want to ask you about, didn't immediately seem as hopeless as it wound up being. Going into Iraq always seemed to me to be a dangerous distraction from the war in Afghanistan. And obviously the connection to 9/11 was tenuous at best, but I certainly shared your view that getting rid of Saddam Hussein and his psychotic sons had to be an intrinsic good that would suggest that almost any change, even with some considerable collateral damage, would be better and better for Iraqis. And of course, you know, in hindsight, it looks like a terrible misadventure. What was your view at the time, and how did it evolve?
Well, I had, I mean, obviously these things were taking place when I was walking across Asia. So I missed 9/11 entirely. I was in a remote region of northern Nepal, and I didn't find out about 9/11 until I think the 18th of September, when I was arrested and accused of being an Al-Qaeda activist. And then I walked across Afghanistan between the end of 2001, so just after 9/11, through to March of 2002. I think the thing that struck me...
Let's just hover over that for a second. It doesn't... I mean, that's, on paper at least, looks spectacularly dangerous, right? You're this Westerner walking through Taliban country just as, you know, we are going over the brink into conflict. What was that like? Well, and did you perceive it to be dangerous?
It was, of course, quite dangerous. And a lot of Afghan friends tried to deter me from doing it. My sense, though, was that Afghans are, and this turned out to be true, along with all the other things which are negative about Afghanistan, particularly in rural villages, people are incredibly hospitable, honorable, generous, pretty straightforward. And probably I was much safer walking alone as a man than I would have been if I'd been walking in a larger group. I was frequently very grateful that I wasn't carrying a weapon, because again, I had no opportunity to escalate things when people pulled weapons on me. And truthfully, I walked across Afghanistan and made it across because of the kindness of Afghans who fed me night after night, put me up. And these were people who, many of them were strong Taliban sympathizers. Many of them were very angry with foreigners of all sorts, angry with the Soviet Union because they'd been fighting the Soviet Union during the 80s, angry with the US, angry with Britain, pretty xenophobic. And so I guess I arrived back in Afghanistan, back in Kabul, so in the capital city, in March of that year, already a little bit doubtful about the way that the US and its allies were talking about Afghanistan. I remember coming into a meeting with Hamid Karzai and Ashraf Ghani, who were the people who went on to be the presidents of Afghanistan. And for some reason, I still don't understand, Bianca Jagger, who was a sort of UN ambassador. And they said, I think Ashraf produced the line, every Afghan is committed to a gender-sensitive, multi-ethnic, centralized state based on democracy, human rights, and the rule of law.
Oh my God.
And I just remember thinking, I literally cannot translate this into Dari. I don't know how I would explain this to anybody I stayed with. And yet, literally $3 trillion was spent in Iraq and Afghanistan propagating these kind of ideas, and everybody got sucked into it. And I became increasingly angry because I believed that we could be doing good in Afghanistan, but not through this mad project of nation building. So I imagined a light footprint that we could provide some modest support to the Afghan government, except it was going to be imperfect and not get dragged too far in. But by 2008, you had President Obama dragged in, you had these surges, you had 150,000 troops on the ground, and the situation just getting worse and worse and worse. And I, you know, it was a real introduction for me to both about the illusions and obsessions of government. Quite literally, you know, I remember President Obama making a speech where he said, the only way to catch Osama bin Laden is to win in Afghanistan and stabilize Pakistan. Now, if you think about that, the statement was patently nonsense even at the time. And sure enough, a few months later, he caught Osama bin Laden without winning in Afghanistan and stabilizing Pakistan. But people were just generating nonsense. And and I think it was very painful, partly for the US. I remember Strobe Talbot, who was a big State Department, been a former very senior State Department official, saying to me in a very angry engagement, he said, Rory, stop producing problems, produce solutions. This is America. Stop telling us what we can't do. Tell us how to do it. And I was trying to say, you cannot do this. You cannot turn Afghanistan into the kind of country you imagine. I can spend hours trying to explain why, but the punchline is you can't do it.
Well, let's explain why. I mean, on its face, if you just look at the last 100 years of history, you wouldn't necessarily draw the conclusion that a nation-building project is, by definition, hopeless. I mean, you look at what happened after World War II, you look at Nazi Germany and Japan, and what we did over there after bombing them, halfway to oblivion, it's fairly miraculous what's happened. I mean, we helped them rebuild their societies, and we created in both countries durable allies, right? And so you might say, well, German culture, as deranged as it was under Hitler, was still close enough to our own that, there wasn't much of a cultural translation required once we rebooted their society as friends. But you really couldn't quite say the same thing of Imperial Japan.
Yeah. So, Sam, I think
the...
Why
are those bad analogies?
I think they're bad analogies partly because of this we thing. I think at best, these nation-building projects, the U.S. can act like a sort of midwife or a facilitator in a supporting role, providing resources, providing advice when wanted, but fundamentally the work has to be done by the countries themselves. And the reason why Germany and Japan were able to rebuild in a way Afghanistan wasn't is that one forgets that Germany and Japan were amongst the most advanced countries on earth. They had extraordinary industrial bases, highly educated populations, a very well-organized state. I mean, the Japanese state had been in existence in its modern form for 600-700 years by the time you intervened. It had a highly developed bureaucracy, civil service. It had beaten the Russian Navy in 1905, 40 years earlier. Hmm. Germany, was the great intellectual musical capital of Europe and one of the most educated industrial nations on earth. So even with all the damage that was done during the war, and extraordinary damage, right, and a lot of people killed and a lot of infrastructure destroyed, the human capital you were working with was completely different. I mean, Afghanistan, in most villages I went to in that period, there I would find usually one person in the village who could read or write to a basic standard. When we would, many years later, 10 years later, I went to see the police training in Helmand. And I think they calculated that 8 out of 100 recruits could write their names or recognize numbers up to 5. Women in these communities had not been more than 3 hours walk from their village in their lives. It was a wonderful, wonderful country, but it was not a centralized, organized state like Germany or Japan. I mean, these villages had been basically without any form of government for nearly 40 years, in vendetta with their neighbors, living a very basic subsistence life, no electricity between Herat and Kabul. But the problem was that communicating this is so difficult. I mean, Sam, I know you've spent time in the developing world, but it's very, very, very difficult explaining to people who haven't lived in these villages what they're actually like and the gap between, I remember an American on a plane saying to me just after the Arab Spring, saying, do you think there can be a Facebook revolution in Afghanistan? And I was having to explain, there's literally no electricity between Herat and Kabul. Mm. Almost nobody can read and write. How are you going to have a Facebook revolution?
How would you differentiate the challenge of Afghanistan and Iraq? They seem different in some important ways. Maybe these are differences of degree, but how doomed were those respective projects and how would you compare them?
So I think Iraq was more doomed. I think Afghanistan, if you'd set your bar very low, if you'd said our aim is to create a slightly more prosperous, slightly more peaceful Afghanistan in 20 years' time than it is today, and we're going to contain terrorist attacks, we would have been able to do this. I think the situation that the US had before Biden's catastrophic withdrawal, so the situation that existed at the beginning of 2020, was a good situation. Now, it was a situation where no American troops had been killed for 18 months, no British troops had been killed since 2014. You had about 2,500 soldiers on the ground. The Taliban were not in the position to take any major city. There was not a major Al-Qaeda group based in the country. That could have continued almost indefinitely, but it required setting very low objectives, not getting involved in fantasizing about nation building. Iraq was completely different. I mean, Iraq is, it was a much more developed state, a much more educated country, vast natural resources, had been run by an autocratic dictator. And the difference was that in Iraq, by toppling Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party, we basically removed all the infrastructure of the state and government, whereas in Afghanistan, these things didn't exist.
Do you think the de-Baathification was a mistake?
Well, I think it was a mistake for the North. The problem is it was necessary in the South. I mean, the population I was with, the community I was with, who were Shia Muslims who'd suffered terribly under Saddam Hussein, absolutely demanded the dismantling of the Ba'ath Party and would have been horrified if it hadn't happened. So in a way, the problem in Iraq is you were damned if you did, damned if you didn't.
So how much of the failure of Iraq was due to our not appreciating the level of religious sectarianism and just the capacity for internecine violence there, and are just having made no real provision to deal with it, had we even anticipated it?
Well, I think America has a really difficult job dealing with these countries, really difficult job, because you don't want to be an empire, right? You don't want to behave like the British Empire. So you're very uncomfortable cutting political deals with tribal and religious groups, which is the way that the British often did it. You're uncomfortable with indirect rule. You're uncomfortable with corruption. You want to create a very pure society. So you're coming in straight away. You want to rewrite the constitution. You want to work out how you're going to do the university curriculums. You were trying to set up a stock exchange. You were worrying about how many women were in parliament. So you're doing all that good stuff, but highly, highly idealistic. And on the other end of things, you are deploying 100,000 soldiers in an incredibly aggressive military machine. And it's not surprising the local population sees a lot of soldiers who, frankly, were often extremely rude and were often shooting at people and not take very seriously the idealistic language they're hearing from Washington.
But shouldn't the idealism have been a strength? I mean, again, had it been implemented by more courteous soldiers?
I mean, but you don't have courteous soldiers, really. I mean, I think that's the problem. I think the U.S. tradition of law enforcement compared to European tradition is quite harsh. I mean, I'm very struck whenever I encounter a U.S. policeman or a U.S. soldier. It's a very authoritarian, quite aggressive style, which is very unsuitable for dealing with people in cultures that are, at a personal level at least, often scrupulously polite. I mean, I remember seeing senior sheikhs and religious figures sweating for 8 hours outside U.S. embassies or civilian positions waiting to go in for meetings, and you'd lost your friends by the time they came in through the door. I mean, you're very, very, I mean, this is unfair because I'm making sort of cultural stereotypes about the U.S., but it never struck me that you're particularly empathetic to or interested in the manners of other people's cultures. You give the impression that the U.S. has the right system and everybody should be following an American model. And therefore, you don't really have the patience for the 20, 30 years of work that would be involved to actually enable and midwife and facilitate and bring along people on a journey of development.
Yeah, well, we did, patience or not, we did spend the 20 years in Afghanistan and have, as you know, very little to show for it, as do the Afghans. But so I want to come back to the point about corruption you made. It sounds like, on your account, we should be more comfortable with all of the gray areas and the loss of idealism and the need to, you know, split various babies so as to get things done in extremis. But I remember these stories where you'd hear that, you know, some warlord, and I'm thinking of Afghanistan, you know, some warlord who we had empowered as our surrogate or with whom we were collaborating, you know, is also found to be, raping boys in his bedroom, right? And this is just viewed as intolerable from the point of view of the U.S. military or the U.S. government. And well, it should be, right? I mean, like, how is it that we can collaborate with someone who's, you know, raping preteen boys in his bedroom? Wouldn't we expect, again, perhaps naively, that the population wouldn't want us to tolerate such a thing?
Well, Sam, I mean, that's a very good example you've used because that was central to the whole thing. So you're absolutely right. After the intervention in Afghanistan 2001, from then until 2005, 2006, initially, the U.S. had quite a light footprint and it let President Karzai's government get on, and that involved some pretty nasty figures, particularly in places like Helmand in the south. And you're right, they were involved in horrible activities, corruption, drug dealing, human rights abuses. The question then is, bluntly, what was the alternative? And the US and their allies, and this wasn't just the US, you know, Britain's to blame for this as well, and Holland and many other countries, decided that what they would do is get rid of these people and replace them with clean technocrats and replace the militias that these people had with foreign soldiers. But then you're in the you break it, you own it problem. So from 2008 onwards, effectively, with 150,000 troops on the ground and 150,000 foreign consultants and an expenditure of over $100 billion a year, the US and its allies were trying to run Afghanistan themselves. And of course, that's absurd because we don't really know anything about Afghanistan. Very, very few of the people on the ground, very few, could speak an Afghan language fluently. Security requirements didn't allow you to be outside the bases or spend a night in an Afghan house. Even the US that did longer deployments were on 9 months, maximum 12-month deployments before people were cycled out and put back in again. So you're absolutely right that it's intolerable in the modern world to be involved in situations of such intense moral ambiguity. But if that's the case, then my suspicion is you don't want to embark on a course of nation building, because the alternative, which is to pretend that the US has the knowledge, the legitimacy, the power to be able to micromanage how a district is run in southern Afghanistan is, I'm afraid, and has been demonstrated over 20 years, to be patent nonsense.
So you referred to our exit from Afghanistan as catastrophic. It certainly was catastrophic in its implementation. Do you think the exit itself, just exiting on any terms, was a bad idea? Should we have maintained some force there?
We definitely should have done, Sam. As I said, you had 2,500 soldiers there. You hadn't had any soldiers killed in 18 months. To put that in context, you have 25,000 troops in Korea. Right? It was costing the US very little, it was costing the UK very little, costing NATO very little, and you were preventing the Taliban from taking the country, largely with air power from bases, at minimal risk and minimal cost. The withdrawal from Afghanistan handed the country back to the Taliban, destroyed the reputation of the United States throughout the world, and just exacerbated the pattern that has gone on from President Obama's failure to hold the red lines in Syria.
Yeah.
And was a very, very bad decision. It's an unjustifiable decision. There was no benefit to the United States or to the Afghans from doing it.
And what is the state of Afghanistan now? I don't know how much you have been following it since the withdrawal, but one imagines that many good things happened despite all the pain on all sides that was felt. I mean, we have girls going back to school and, you know, or going to school for the first time, and the Taliban having far less control of the country. When we left, was Afghanistan essentially returned to the year 2000, or is it in the process of being returned there, or worse? What's the state of things?
It's a very mixed picture. So the Taliban have not done what they did before 2001. They haven't engaged in mass killing. So the UN report suggests that there have been 235 people killed in extrajudicial executions in the last 2.5 years. That's horrible, but that's far fewer than people thought.
Yeah.
There hasn't been mass retribution. There's been an amnesty. The economy has suffered. It's probably contracted by 40%. Women cannot go to school, particularly once they reach puberty. There are a few exceptions, but broadly speaking, the situation of women in Afghanistan is very bad. And many Afghan men, as well as Afghan women, are extremely angry about the opportunities that are being taken away from their daughters. Women can work in limited positions, but they're segregated. I guess the big improvement in Afghan lives is an improvement in security. You can now travel safely from Kabul to Bamiyan, you can have a picnic by the side of the road, you can go to areas that we haven't been able to go to for 20 years. But again, the Taliban shouldn't be praised for that, because the reason the security's improved is the Taliban are not setting off bombs anymore.
Yeah. So I don't know how much you know of, how much I've touched the topic of Islam, generally and jihadism in particular. I tend to view most of our entanglements in the Muslim world through the lens of, you know, what do highly conservative Muslims think about the presence of infidels in their culture, right, for whatever purpose? And how combustible is that juxtaposition in principle, right? And you know, very much viewed from the side of Islam, and in particular, I mean, where it really becomes excruciating, through the eyes of jihadists who view these collisions as, you know, a provocation, again, in principle. To what degree was Islam the answer to the question of why both of these engagements, in particular, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq, I mean, there are obviously other fronts on which this is happening, but to what degree is Islam the reason why these were, in principle, fool's errands? The idea that we could have ever, as an infidel occupying power, gone in and sorted things out was doomed from the start, and it was doomed because of an underlying religious belief system that we couldn't, again, by definition, interact with appropriately from its point of view. And, you know, I guess we can take jihadism as its own extreme piece here. How much of that was the problem, or would you have expected this in any other condition of similar cultural difference without the influence of religious ideology?
Well, it's difficult to fully answer that. I think clearly Afghans were more conservative, more religious than we wanted to acknowledge. And when I talk to people in Iraq and Afghanistan, people would often say, we're fighting against a foreign, non-Muslim military occupation. So that was an important part of the narrative and the mobilization. But I think probably nationalism in the end is more important than religion. I think the nationalism precedes it. I think people don't like foreigners trying to boss them around. And they will reach for religion when it suits them. And religion can be a very powerful motive force. But, you know, if you think about, well, probably most straightforward examples would be the British in Palestine in the 30s and 40s or the Americans in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So the British in Palestine in the 30s and 40s, of course, were under attack from Muslim terrorist groups, but they were also under attack from Jewish terrorist groups. Famously, Jewish terrorist groups blew up the King David Hotel and killed a lot of British officials and including some women in that hotel in the late 40s. Again, in Vietnam, there wasn't a religious element, right? It wasn't Jewish or Muslim. It was predominantly a nationalist element. But again, it cloaked itself in the ideology of communism.
Hmm.
So I tend to think that, yes, there are many things that are distinctive about Islam. But it's also true, I was thinking today about the Hindu massacres in Gujarat, where in 2002, under Narendra Modi's chief ministership, Muslims suffered the most astonishing, unbearable atrocities in the streets of Gujarat. Or the Burmese army, which are Buddhist, and their attacks on the Rohingya Muslims in Western Burma. So I tend to think that it's nationalism that's the problem more than religion.
I'm thinking in particular now about jihadism and the modern tactic of suicide bombing and how that must make the kind of courtesy you were hoping for on the part of soldiers and any other bureaucracy really more or less impossible in a wide range of circumstances. I mean, just having to anticipate the possibility that someone showing up at a checkpoint is actually a bomb, right? I mean, just how that must make everything just incredibly fraught on a daily basis. I mean, you have much more experience with being in that environment than I do, but, you know, we all have some experience of it, just having to travel on airplanes. I mean, we've been taking our shoes off for the better part of, you know, a quarter of a century because of one person, you know, who tried to blow himself up on an airplane. And it's brutalized all of us on some level, that is to say, made us more brutish and paranoid, but for understandable reasons. I mean, from my point of view, I mean, nationalism doesn't, I completely concede that nationalism is a strong motivation for people.
Well, national terrorism, I suppose, is what I'm talking about, because I don't think, I mean, I think, you know, the I agree, a suicide bomber is a very particular form of threat, but the same would be true if you were, I don't know, a British soldier in Palestine in the 40s. You're worried all the time that when you're stepping out of a car, that you're going to be shot. You're worried someone's putting a bomb in your hotel. I guess the same would have been true in Vietnam. So I think you're right. And it's what terrorists deliberately try to do. And Islamist terrorists are among the leading exponents of this. What they're trying to do is make it impossible for you to interact with the population and be courteous, because they know that if they can frighten you, and you're quite understandable, as you say, that you'd be frightened and you retreat and you put yourself behind big walls and you search people aggressively and you can't spend a night in anyone's house and you can't have a decent conversation with them, it's going to be impossible for you to win over hearts and minds, which is why, you know, General Stanley McChrystal in Afghanistan talked about courageous restraint, and he understood that the only possibility of winning the hearts and minds of people was by taking risk and not trying to get to a zero risk environment. And I definitely felt, working in Iraq and working in Afghanistan, that I had to take risk, that if there was a big crowd outside my office with a sign in Iraq saying death to the governor, what I had to do was walk out the door and talk to them, not hide inside, because obviously your opponents are trying to make you hide. They're trying to separate you from the population.
Should we reopen our embassy in Afghanistan?
I think it'll take a bit of time, but I think that we have to be realistic about the fact that there are 30 million people in Afghanistan in a very terrible situation, that the Taliban government isn't going anywhere. There's no viable opposition to the Taliban. So I think the idea of a path where opening the embassy is the very end of that path, but where you begin to talk about what would be involved, what concessions you'd look for from a Taliban government on the path to that, I think is a diplomatic act worth engaging in, yes.
Well, what about the level of conspiracy thinking that seems, I mean, this is obviously a global problem, and it is true of probably every culture, certainly every culture that's online, but it does seem to be an especially prominent feature of the Muslim world. I mean, just the kinds of conspiracies you hear indulged. Perhaps the first one that many of us noticed was that, you know, 4,000 Jews didn't show up for work September 11th in the World Trade Center.
Certain societies love conspiracy theories, and I think there are lots of countries in the Middle East that love conspiracy theories, partly because their governments are pretty conspiratorial. The other people who love conspiracy theories are the Russians. And again, it's because their government's so unbelievably weirdly conspiratorial. I mean, it's not surprising that, you know, Russians also believe in large numbers that 9/11 was a hoax, because it turned out that a lot of these apparent Chechen attacks in Moscow had actually been put together by the KGB, pretending to be Chechen. So they're living in societies in which a lot of crazy stuff is going on, and a lot of lying is taking place. But you're right, yes, that there are societies where there are a lot of conspiracy theories, and the Middle East is absolutely rife with them. And one of the problems at the moment in talking about what's happening in Gaza is that social media simply exacerbates this. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff circulating on both sides. There are lies from both sides. There are truths from both sides. And nobody's giving a fair hearing to any of it. Everybody is in a kind of partisan camp of craziness.
What if anything, could we do with respect to social media and how we interact with the information landscape that could improve things? I mean, are you active on social media, and would you encourage politicians to be active there? Do you think a retreat from it makes sense? I mean, what does one do?
No, I think we have to be active. We have to lean into it. It's such a dominant form. But I think I ran to be prime minister against Boris Johnson, and my ability to do that and launch an independent campaign and raise money was all due to social media. And it, you know, one of the consequences for good or ill of social media is it is democratizing in politics in many countries. The US is one of them. It makes you less dependent on big donors. It allows you to bring in grassroots donations from people and escape the influence of a few wealthy individuals. And it allows you to launch campaigns from nothing. Very difficult to imagine Macron becoming president of France without social media. But at the same time, I don't think it's I talked at the beginning about how 1988 to 2004, the number of democracies doubled and the world was becoming more peaceful. I don't think it's an accident that since 2014, things have been going in the other direction, that every year the world's become more violent, there have been more refugees, more internally displaced people, the number of democracies has declined. I think that's partly about the US withdrawal. I think that's a major factor. I think US isolationism, many liberals hoped that if the US was less involved, the world would get more peaceful, and that turned out not to be the case. It turned out that, in fact, the US's role, complicated and morally compromised though it was incredibly important in keeping peace, and that the alternative to a US-dominated world has not been peace. It's been lots of other bad actors emerging. And social media, I think, is also part of the story, because I think social media has obviously deepened polarization. It's facilitated populist movements in the US and right across Europe. I mean, we're talking at a time when the AfD, which is a neo-Nazi party in Germany, is now the leading party in the polls, right? They're ahead of the governing party. Mm. And this is a party where literally the members are hearing addresses from people who are sticking swastikas on the side of synagogues as young men and who are using Nazi slogans. So I know, Sam, you've, for understandable reasons, are very focused on Islam and the Muslim world, but I think these phenomena are much broader. And I don't think they're limited to Muslims. And I think we're seeing an extraordinary amount of very, very worrying developments in all our democracies and societies. I think what we're seeing in Russia, Ukraine, and what we're seeing with Israel, Gaza, are more worrying, actually, than any of the problems that followed on from 9/11.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. And not to mislead you about the nature of my focus on Islam. I take all of your caveats there, except I would just add that I think the addition of an explicit doctrine of martyrdom and a belief system that supports it, on all sides, both from the martyr's eye view and from the perception of the martyr in the wider community. I just think that it raises the stakes, and it, more important than anything else, it's the only type of belief system that explicitly removes what is in every other kind of conflict, the rational backstop that limits, or at least promises to limit, the scope of the violence.
Yeah, although, Sam, I'd say that's right, but Shahid martyrs of that sort, suicide bombers, are a relatively small component. I knew very few Afghans who wanted to strap a bomb onto their front.
Yeah.
You're talking about a few hundred people a year doing it in Afghanistan. The Taliban defeated us not because of suicide bombers. I mean, the Taliban victory was a really interesting thing that I don't think we've got our heads around. Remember, all our militaries, the UK military as much as the US, have been betting hard for 20 years now that it's all about technology, all about cyber, it's all about drones, it's all about thinking about the use of AI, it's about amazing imagery and surveillance and precision weapons. And the Taliban effectively beat us with a bunch of Kalashnikovs, which is a sort of 1940s technology, riding around on ponies. And they did so fundamentally because it was a nationalist movement. It was a movement to throw off what they perceived as a foreign occupation, and particularly a corrupt collaborating government and a foreign occupation. And there's an astonishing power in that, which we haven't yet got our head around.
Let me just add a question to the point you're making, which I think you will probably easily answer. Clear up this mystery for us. The Taliban, Afghans in general, are often described as these great warriors, and this was part of the problem in our fighting the Taliban. But then, why was it that government forces, which come from the same Afghan stock, which had the benefit of weaponry we gave them and additional training we gave them, why did government forces so amazingly melt away in the face of the Taliban? Why did they prove so inept?
I think the first thing is that they had been fighting very bravely for 20 years and had lost an enormous number of people. I mean, the Afghan military casualties were far higher than those of the US or the UK. They were also entirely dependent. The US had created an Afghan military that was entirely dependent on US machinery, US technology, and US air support. And the most dramatic thing that Biden did was not removing the troops, it was removing the people who maintained the aircraft. There were thousands of American engineers who were required to fix these incredibly high-tech helicopters and planes. And these Afghan soldiers have been put in forward operating bases, very small, isolated forts, which were completely dependent on this air support for their ammunition, for their water, and for their medical evacuation. So we'd created an army based on this high-tech machinery that they couldn't run themselves, and that effectively we switched off when we left, leaving these small isolated bases out there with no possibility of getting ammunition, water, or medical evacuation. And we also did it almost overnight. I mean, they basically woke up and the Americans had vanished. You would pick up the phone to the base in Bagram and nobody would pick up. It was a very, very strange thing that we did. And more fundamental, though, is, you know, you talked about why somebody from one country gives up. I mean, it was true. The Vietnamese were the same in the North and the South, but ultimately they lost faith in their government. They lost faith in the Kabul government. They decided that it was a bunch of corrupt people who just didn't have the staying power. And it was a drop of morale. I mean, I think it's the same with the South Vietnamese. I mean, people, I think, were astonished how easily North Vietnam took South Vietnam. And why did all these people that we'd trained and we'd given equipment to vanish? Well, it wasn't that they were less brave than their North Vietnamese equivalents or that the Afghan soldiers were less brave than the Taliban. They were often their brothers or cousins with exactly the same culture and courage. It was simply that when an army collapses, it's astonishing what happens. Look at the French in World War II. But the French had been pretty brave in the First World War. They'd been pretty brave under Napoleon. But when everything goes wrong, the whole thing can collapse in a couple of days.
Yeah. I just want to return to the topic of Islam, however briefly.
It's something on your mind, Sam.
Yeah, well, I don't want our listeners to be confused about what either of us think, but obviously I only know what I think here. I certainly take your point that the majority of Muslims, even extremely devout and conservative Muslims, are not aspiring suicide bombers. But the fact that you have whole cultures wherein a very large percentage of people are fairly sure and even absolutely sure about the reality of paradise and the reality of martyrdom as a path to it, that changes. I mean, the fact that you can have people who sincerely chant, "We love death more than the infidels love life, or the Jews love life, or the Americans love life," where that's not just mere posturing, but it is actually a confession of a worldview, and it's an honest expression of a psychology. That's just worse than ordinary nationalism. I mean, it'd be worse if the Nazis were also certain of paradise. Right, where you couldn't have people who had rational terrestrial interests once you...
Although, Sam, they were pretty happy to die. I mean, I think...
Well, some of them were, but...
maybe that's the methamphetamine. Like 150,000 Germans committed suicide when they heard about Hitler's death.
Yeah. I mean, it was a cult. I mean, it was a personality cult as well.
I think effective armies, great militaristic nations, are full of people, full of young men in particular, who are comfortable dying. There's a particular thing of celebrating a particular type of martyr, which you're right is an Islamic phenomenon, but all our countries are full, or traditionally were anyway, of huge veneration of young men going out to give their lives for their country.
Take me to the Islamic State then. What do you make of the success with which the Islamic State recruited from scores of countries? And you literally have cases of people dropping out of the London School of Economics to go fight for the caliphate. That's not tapping into somebody's immediate need in extremis to defend their nation from outsiders. This is somebody who has many other opportunities in life, but they have heard this message. They've heard this call for really spiritual aspiration, right? This is not mere belligerence. This is a very idealistic project. Come to Syria and Iraq and be part of this triumphal moment for the one true religion that is in the process of being spread to the ends of the earth. Come one, come all. And we found that, again, it's not the majority of people in medical school in Britain, but you find people who are susceptible to this message. And it's not the same thing as soldiers who are too cultic and extreme in their nationalism, right? This is just
it's not exactly the same, Sam. But it's also, I mean, there are echoes, and I think it's important to try to understand that. Look, ISIS was the most horrifying, disgusting, ignorant, brutal force, but the idea of educated, young men and a few women wanting to go off and do something crazy and idealistic and dangerous at the other end of the world, it is not that unusual. You know, some of those people would mock me and say, listen, Rory, I've just did what you did. What the hell did you do? You know, you went to Oxford and you decided to move off. I volunteered to go off to Iraq and govern a province in Iraq. And it wasn't because I felt my nation was in existential danger. I guess the whole British Empire was powered on people who left highly educated jobs to go and risk their lives because they had some sort of combination of adventure, excitement, idealism, missionary zeal. So,
well, I guess that's to my point that the specific beliefs matter. I mean, you know, I'm very different from you in the details, but you know, in my 20s, I also did extreme things. I mean, I spent nearly 2 years in silence on Buddhist meditation retreats. You know, it's an extreme thing to do. You drop out of a good college and go sit in silence in a room somewhere, you know, abandoning every other life prospect. I had my reasons, and had my reasons been a devout commitment to the truth of Islam, I would have done something different, and it could have looked a lot like what, you know, John Walker Lynn did. You know, he leaves Marin or some, I think it was Marin, some cushy neighborhood in California, and he decides to go learn Arabic and fight alongside the Taliban. Again, the it's what you think you know is true that and what you think you know is good that really matters. And that, so that I just what I continue to worry about is the contagious nature of specific ideas.
I'm with you. I'm not really disagreeing that obviously that there are those tendencies and that ISIS is a particularly deranged and horrifying form of it. But look at what's happening with Russia and Ukraine. I mean, they are increasingly convinced that they are involved, that Russia is a unique and special country whose destiny is to save Western civilization. And they believe that in Ukraine, they are saving Western civilization from the horrors of Nazis, Americans, and, you know, a whole series of other people, irreligious people, atheists, materialists. And I think there are people who really believe that. I think there's a circle around Putin. Probably Putin himself has spent 2 years in an almost silent retreat during COVID reading this kind of books and getting this into his head. And yes, there are criminals and conscripts, but there are a lot of Russians going out there with funny beliefs. To push you onto uncomfortable ground, there are people like Smotrich in Israel, who's in the Israeli cabinet, who genuinely believes that the entire territory from the Jordan River to the sea by Gaza is his because he's read in the Bible that somebody called Joseph was born in a particular place that he believes he can identify, and that therefore there should not be Palestinian Arabs there. That should be an Israeli place. And that Hebron should again be settled because this is where somebody called Abraham, and honestly, I don't think you or I, Sam, actually believe that we even know there was anybody called Abraham, right? That this is where this person was buried, right? So, I mean, you're right. There are differences between different religions. There are differences between different nationalist ideologies and religions. But humans' capacity to create belief systems that lead to extreme political violent action is just staggering. And of course, the Nazis managed to do it while being atheists. I don't think it's just a religious phenomenon either.
No, I would agree. I mean, it's the generic features are false certainty, you know, false and divisive certainty, dogmatism, and the social phenomenon of this kind of cultic attachment to symbols, right, and to specific demagogues. And so we see many of the features of cultic religion in what are, you know, political religions, or, you know, as you pointed out, Stalinism and Maoism are just as energizing in their own orbit, or nearly so. So to bring us back to the great unraveling we're witnessing and the causes of it, I mean, we have populism, we have isolationism. I think I just read in The Atlantic that the number of state-based conflicts at the moment are, I think it's over 50, and this is at its highest level since 1946, right? So we're definitely losing some of the gains of that we had have been taking for granted since the end of World War II. What are you most concerned about? And let's just take this year. We have, from an American perspective, the presidential election seems to be casting a shadow over everything. What are you most worried about? And then I want to turn toward your experience in politics and ask you why our politics, as a way of sorting this out, has become so ineffectual and toxic and personally demeaning.
Well, what I'm worried about is that the trends that we've seen and that you've described so articulately are just going to get worse. That there's a reasonable chance, looking forward over the next decade, that there will every year we will see fewer democracies, more authoritarian states, more refugees, more conflicts, technology exacerbating political division. In other words, you know, I've talked about relatively mild trend. 2014, well, I guess the story is roughly this. 2003-04, you get Facebook and Twitter launched with huge ability to polarize. You get the 2008 financial crisis. You get the humiliations of Iraq and Afghanistan. And that leads you into an age of populism. And from 2014 onwards, we get Narendra Modi elected in India. We get the Law and Justice Party in Poland. We get Trump. We get Brexit. We get Bolsonaro. And the world gets more dangerous and more violent. My fear is that the negative forces are outweighing the positive. And Trump's election is going to have a huge impact on Russia-Ukraine because he's signaled that he intends to fix the situation in a day, which presumably means cutting a deal with Putin, which I think is likely to embolden Putin and make him more aggressive, not less. I think that he's not serious about trying to do anything to resolve the situation in the Middle East. I think we can expect a continuing deterioration in Africa. But I think the bigger problem, in a way, is that Trump is making all the running. Everybody's becoming a mini Trump. Hmm. In some ways, what Trump began on protectionist trade policy, on the US withdrawing from the world, hasn't really been fundamentally challenged by Biden. I mean, after all, as I say, Biden left Afghanistan, which I thought was a catastrophic mistake. He was pretty reluctant to get involved in the Middle East peace process. He did get involved in Ukraine-Russia, for which he deserves credit. But that's the kind of shining exception to a general sense that the US is much more inward-focused. And that's partly because Trump has found a very rich seam of voters. I mean, this is then me talking as a politician. He's making the political weather. And he's shaping people around him. And it's more and more difficult to make the kind of arguments that we would have made in the 1990s for constitutions, for human rights, for free trade, for markets, for the responsibility to protect, for the United Nations, for the international system, or any of this stuff.
Well, what would you say to, I'm not usually in the habit of defending Trump or his supporters, but I think the most charitable interpretation of their isolationism is that it's not isolationism per se, it's just that they perceive the rest of the world, of Western Europe, and even Britain as having been free riders of a sort, right? Not having paid enough into their own capacities to defend themselves, and that Trump is really just trying to kind of reset expectations and get all these democracies to shoulder their fair share of the burden of maintaining order worldwide.
Well, it's, I mean, as with everything that Trump says, there's a little bit of truth and there's a lot of mischaracterization there. Yeah. He's absolutely right that the US has kept the peace of the world since the mid-1940s. And it's done a disproportionate amount. I mean, there was a reason why Germany wasn't carrying a burden through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which is people didn't want Germany rearming and having a big army.
Yeah.
Ditto Japan. Britain did keep spending, but it never spent as much as the US. But remember, the British economy is literally one-tenth the size of the US economy. I mean, we have to kind of put it in context. And yes, America has spent enormously on keeping the world safe and spent enormously on its military, but America has also benefited tremendously from that. An incredible amount of the technology and research and progress in the US was driven from this military-industrial complex. And instead of bankrupting yourself by doing it, you have gone on to be the wealthiest country in the world with a growth rate that's still the envy of the rest of the world.
Hmm.
And it's been a pretty good deal, I think. I mean, it doesn't look like it on the pan. I mean, you look at it on the surface, you think this is ridiculous. You know, what's America doing? We're wasting all our money being charitable to other people. But the truth of the matter is this has been the great American century. And the moment at which you were paying for other people and keeping world peace coincided with a time of extraordinary global prosperity that was hugely beneficial, actually, ultimately for the United States, because it was customers for American goods, it was DoD spending, creating the beginnings of the internet, creating a lot of the foundations of a lot of the technological innovations of our whole era come out of DoD spending. So I think the problem with Trump's view is firstly, it's zero sum. It's underestimating how much America has benefited from being the global policeman and its defense spending. I think the second thing is it's completely unrealistic. The fact is that Europe is not going to step up. Now, that may be unfair and ridiculous, but it's just the fact. It would be a bit like my having a kind of, let's say I had a kind of slightly hopeless, I don't know, uncle who I was sort of supporting. And I sort of thought, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to cut off the money and I'm going to force my hopeless 65-year-old uncle to pull his finger out and start really kind of pulling his weight in the world. Well, the fact is my hopeless 65-year-old uncle probably isn't going to step up. He's probably just going to be a slightly more shambolic, pathetic version of what he is. And I don't really want to characterize Europe in that, but the evidence is there.
Why is Europe our shambolic uncle at this point?
Because Europe is, well, I mean, German growth is minus 0.3% contraction at the moment. The European economies are performing very badly. There is a massive migration crisis. They are divided. It's not a country like the United States. Yes, it's 300 million people, but it's divided into 26 member states, all of them with different systems, all of them with huge political problems, trying to coordinate all their different armies. And they don't have a tradition of being a global policeman. So what Trump has demonstrated is that when the US withdraws, it's not Europe that steps up. What steps up when the US withdraws is other militaristic large nations, of which Russia and China are prime examples. Those are the kind of countries that will fill the gap. It's not that Italy is suddenly going to say, oh, okay, thanks, the US has left, so we're really going to worry about what's happening in Eastern Congo. And that may be unfair, but I think part of the problem with this worldview is that you're being too idealistic here. You're not being realistic. If you're realistic about it, look at what happens. America withdraws, Russia gets into Syria when you fail to hold the red line. America withdraws, Russia gets into Crimea. America withdraws, Russia gets into Ukraine. And in the Horn of Africa, America withdraws. It's not Italy that steps in. It's Turkey, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Libya. America withdraws. It's Turkey, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt that's getting involved, Sudan, the same. So you're creating space not for cheerful European actors to carry their weight, much as though you might fantasize about that. You're creating space for bad actors.
How would you characterize Britain's place in the world now? And I guess I should probably ask you about Brexit. Is it clear at this point that Brexit was a bad idea? And is it so clear that even those who sincerely wanted it now recognize it was a bad idea? Or are opinions just as split as at the time of the referendum?
So many more people now think Brexit was a bad idea than at the time of the referendum. But very few people want to reverse it. So it's a paradox. People think it was the wrong decision, but they don't want to go back. Why was it the wrong decision? I think one of the major reasons it was the wrong decision is that it was done at exactly the wrong time. The argument of the Brexiteers, I was on the Remain side. I wanted to stay in the European Union. But my colleagues who wanted to leave had a fantasy, again, we're going back to this, a fantasy from the 1990s of a world of free trade where Britain would open up all its borders and be this great kind of trading nation. And we'd connect ourselves to the rapidly growing economies of China and India and the US and separate ourselves off from protectionist Europe. And of course, we did it at exactly a moment at which the US was less and less friendly to free trade, in which China turned out to be a strategic adversary, and it seemed extremely stupid to integrating our economy too closely with China. And India didn't want to have anything to do with it. So we're now pushed back to the realization that, for better or worse, Europe are our closest neighbors, they're our strongest trading partners, and that it's a pretty cold world out there in which there wasn't an easy chance to become the fantasy the Brexiteers had, which is Singapore on Thames. They thought, you know, we'll get rid of the... I mean, it was basically a sort of... It was a right-wing fantasy. The idea was that you'd get rid of all the regulations that were holding you back. You'd get rid of the dead hand and bureaucracy of Europe, and you'd create this kind of stripped-down, low-tax, open economy that would grow rapidly. And somewhere in the back of people's minds, I guess, was some sort of fantasies about Britain's preeminence in the 19th century.
Mm. And why was that so? Why should that have been recognized as obviously quixotic and unlikely to come about? I mean, to hear you state it that way, it seems, you know, why couldn't Britain create a Singapore on the Thames?
Well, I think there are two reasons for that. One of them is that the British people don't want the sacrifices that are involved in that. So on the one hand...
You mean they don't want to be caned for chewing gum in public?
We don't want to be caned for chewing gum. We also really like having a generous welfare state, a national health service, which is very expensive. We're a big, expensive country to run. And every time you try to cut regulations, environmental regulations, for example, understandably, people protest. And every time you cut taxes, you end up with public services being cut. We also wouldn't want to treat migrant workers in the way that Singapore does. We wouldn't want to have the kind of authoritarian government that Singapore has. But more fundamentally, our demography is different. We're an aging population. And the thing that really went wrong is the Brexiteers fantasized that we would be able to get wonderful free trade deals with, particularly with the US. That was the big idea was to tilt away from Europe towards the US. And Donald Trump sort of signaled that he was interested in this. But as I said, it was naive. I mean, Trump is not a great believer in win-win trade deals.
Mm-mm.
He wasn't going to lean over backwards and sort of sell out American farmers in order to give UK farmers access to American markets. He wasn't going to allow British financial services and legal firms to swarm all over New York. I mean, it's possible if we had been in the 90s when people were real fundamentalists about free trade and globalization, that Britain could have ridden that wave and had these kind of open free trading arrangements with Argentina and India and China and the US. But that world has passed.
Hmm. Okay, so why have our politics become so dispiriting? I mean, you just went into the swamp and experienced it firsthand in a day-to-day retail way. What lessons did you learn, and what we'll get to what you're doing currently with GiveDirectly and why you pivoted. But just reading your book, it's a great book. It's very depressing to see, in your case, a man of your talents and experience, unable to contribute even where your expertise was greatest. To hear your account of what it's like to talk to your PM about Afghanistan, in some sense, it discredits the whole enterprise. I mean, even when you get the experts in the room, the experts do nothing given our current system and its incentives. So what lessons did you draw, and what would you have us change if we could change it?
Well, thank you, Sam. I mean, I think the first thing is you're right. I mean, how not to be a politician is that, as you say, a description of spending 10 years of my life, as it were, in the lion's den. I stood for election. I was elected 3 times. I was a minister in 6 different government roles: environment, ran prisons, I did development. And it was a deeply, deeply depressing experience. And some of this will be familiar to American listeners. There's the fundraising side of it, which I think is an intensely strange and humiliating thing, trying to get money out of wealthy people who have very, very firm views of their own and want to try to push you to do things that you frequently don't agree with. I think there's the element of the impossibility of these tasks. I mean, one of the problems is a problem of knowledge. If you think about what it really is to be President Biden, and think about the range of things that he ought to know about, international affairs, domestic affairs, I mean, even what's happening in the kind of 50 states of the United States, you very rapidly understand that politicians are bluffing all the time.
Hmm.
So a congresswoman told me that she did a staggering number of hours making donor calls. And the figure that I have in my head is many, many, many thousands of hours. And the impression she gave me is that there was very little time left over in her normal daily life for doing anything other than calling donors. I mean, she gave the impression of spending many hours a day just on the phone to people. The rest of the time, she's engaged in trying to deal with constituents' requests. She's trying to worry about legislative business. She's trying to manage her social media account. She's presumably trying to manage her small office. The idea that she really has the time, let alone the intellectual curiosity, to kind of master the granular details of healthcare reform, international affairs, the car industry in Michigan is for the birds. Mm. And this is true in every advanced democracy, that we are pretending to our voters that we're like some sort of chief executive running a cat food company who might be expected to know what's going on with the cat food. The truth is that we are, it's performative. We're kind of presiding over a system that is so much more complicated. I mean, it's not that we don't understand 90% of it. It's we don't understand 99.999% of what's going on all the time.
And yet we're living in a moment where expertise has been discredited on so many fronts, and institutional trust is at its lowest ebb, I think, that you know, it has to be in many decades. You know, populism is the symptom of that, right? It's explicit in the populist message that, you know, they are trying to screw you and they are the elites and the so-called experts, the mainstream media, as opposed to whatever conspiratorial nonsense you can imbibe on your favorite website run by some 18-year-old in his basement. What do we do in light of that?
I think the answer is, if I'm going to be kind of pompous for a second, I think the answer is Aristotle. So Aristotle says that you've got to do three things. You've got to have your logos, you've got to have your arguments in place, you've got to have your ethos, you've got to have your moral position, and you've got to have your pathos, you've got to have your emotional communication. And I think moderate politicians, the non-extremist politicians of our generation, are very bad at that. So just to run through those things very quickly, the logos bit, we need to have an account of how we're going to run our economies, which is different to the populists, but is also different to the catastrophes that led to 2008. So we can't pretend everything was great with globalization and China and what happened to median incomes in the US and Europe, or what happened with inequality, right? We need a new economic model that has different ways of analyzing investments. We also need a different political model that's realistic about the fact that our current system of representatives don't and can't really represent people in the way that they pretend. So I'd like to see things like citizens' assemblies. I'd like to see the use of the gathering of citizens' juries for people to deliberate directly. But that's on the ideas side, that's the logos side. On the pathos side, we need to find ways of having charisma and communicating with emotion, but also with a bit of a sense of humor. I mean, one of the catastrophes is the populace have got all the jokes. Mm-hmm. I mean, to some extent, Donald Trump, you know, there are many reasons why Ron DeSantis was destroyed, but one of the reasons why he was destroyed is Trump is just much funnier than he is. Boris Johnson in the UK is basically a comedian. I mean, a lot of these guys are actually television personalities and semi-professional comedians when they begin. And then the final thing is the ethos. We have to make the moral argument, and we have to make the moral argument relevant. We have to explain why. I mean, Sam, I really liked your book on lying. I mean, I'd like to plug that on the podcast. It was a very good book. But one of the things that we have to explain to people is why, yes, politicians are shabby, compromised people who produce half-truths all the time, but why truth matters in politics, why the whole democratic system is based on the idea that you have some idea that what somebody says they're doing is what they're doing, and what they promise they're going to do in the future is what they're going to deliver. Otherwise, you've got no basis on which to vote.
It's ethos, at least. It's also logos and pathos. This project of doing good in the world, there are many ways to do it. Obviously, we need governments that also do it, but you are now doing it in the nonprofit space. And you're running an organization that does this in a way that is strangely counterintuitive to many people when they first hear about it. And yet it's, you know, by argument, among the most efficient, if not the most efficient way to help people. Tell us what you're doing at GiveDirectly and why that is a such a promising way of helping people.
Well, thank you. GiveDirectly is, as you say, a pretty radical idea, and it's the result of two revolutions over the last 15, 20 years. One of them is mobile money in Africa, which allows us now to transfer money directly to the extreme poor onto their phones, rather than having to go through governments or intermediaries. And the second is a revolution in research, randomized controlled trials, which were originally used, obviously, for medicines. So, you know, control group, a treatment group in a classic medical trial. One group, I don't know, gets the gets the aspirin, the other group gets the placebo, and you measure over time the impacts, now being applied to development work. So we can now look at development interventions in a way that we weren't able to before. In the past, you know, you'd give money to a charity and you'd get a nice note saying, 10 years later, saying some girl's gone to university from the village you supported, but you had no way of knowing whether it was actually your money that that resulted in that, right? But with a randomized control trial, we can now look at what happens if you give cash to a group of people, and this is unconditional cash. So typically, you'd be giving $700 to a household with no strings attached. It sounds very, very risky. You know, people immediately think, what happens if they spend it on drink? What happens if they waste it? Well, the answer is, if you look at the evidence, it is extraordinary, the impact, and it's more powerful than any other form of multidimensional poverty intervention. In other words, if what you're trying to do is take a village on the Rwanda-Burundi border and you're trying to end up with a situation where people have their roofs fixed, have a toilet, double the amount of electricity, double the amount of livestock, get kids into school, go from eating once every 2 days to eating once every day, you can achieve that with maybe $70,000 of cash going to that village, can achieve what traditional NGOs would have spent millions trying to do, because it puts the power in the hand of the villager. They fix their own roof, find their own food, they buy their own cow, they string their own electricity, they dig their own latrine, and it adjusts to their individual needs. I mean, you, Sam, might want to, you know, be opening a bicycle shop. I might want to open a bakery. You might want have an aunt who was sick. So the cash allows you to adjust to your individual needs. And it does so, I think, to conclude, in a way that gives dignity to people. It gives them the choice. In a world where we're worried about being patronizing and colonial, it steps back and says, you have the choice. You can lead on this.
And where are you most focused at this point? I mean, which specific countries?
So, I mean, a huge thank you also to your listeners who've been incredibly generous to give directly over the years, because we're very much come out of the effective altruism movement, and a lot of your listeners are very interested in that. We work in Kenya, in Uganda, in Rwanda, in Malawi, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in Liberia, and we also have programs actually now beginning in Bangladesh, India, Morocco, and there are smaller, slightly different programs running in the US. But our center point is the extreme poor in Africa, and these are people who are living generally on less than $2 a day. These are people who don't have a decent roof, who are sleeping on the floor, who are eating once a day, once every 2 days. Those are the people that we're mostly focused on.
Does your ability to send it directly through mobile phones totally bypass the problem of political corruption capturing foreign aid? Because you hear these stories of, you know, food aid going to sub-Saharan Africa, and then you have some capture of it, and it's just being sold in the marketplace, you know, and the whoever, whatever tribe or government faction got the aid in the first place is now just selling it. Is there a layer of that problem still existing when you're giving people money directly, or do you manage to bypass that?
There's always challenges, but technology has made it much easier and much simpler. And the biggest thing it's done, yes, it bypasses problems with governments, but I think the most important thing is it means that you spend much less money on staff, on offices, on vehicles, on delivering it. I mean, you can do it much more efficiently. Our most efficient programs, you give $100, 92 of that is arriving directly on someone's phone, because you don't need all the infrastructure that traditional charities have. I mean, a traditional nonprofit will often say they're, I don't know, 90% efficient, but they're counting in that all the costs of their staff, their implementing partners, their cars, their vehicles. This mobile technology allows you to be much more efficient. And we can, you know, we've even started using AI. We did a cooperation with an extraordinary program with the government of Togo during COVID, where we were able to use AI and mobile phone data to target and identify the extreme poor in urban areas on the basis of who they were calling, how many minutes they were using their phones. And a journal article in Nature last year found that this was more accurate than a 60-minute household survey, but it allowed us to do it without any of those associated costs. I mean, it is wonderful. And I think the revolution, the difficult thing is we always think that, you know, development work is about, you know, give someone a fish, they eat for a day, teach them to fish, they eat for a lifetime. What we've discovered is that In fact, we're wasting a lot of money traditionally on these teaching people to fish programs where many people already know how to fish. They just don't have the money for a fishing hook or they don't want to fish. They want to open a bakery.
Yeah. Yeah. And what is the, I mean, this is not going to be news to anyone in the audience, but there is this argument that so much of our charity should be local, right? I mean, the people feel like that there's a, again, this is, I guess, of a piece of with this new spirit of isolationism. Like, you know, why are we helping people over there when we could help, when there are people who need help here? What do you say to that? I mean, fill in with your favorite Peter Singer argument, but remind people of the disparity in wealth across the globe.
I mean, I think, yes, Americans are suffering, but people in poor communities in Africa are suffering far, far more. They're much more likely to die young. They're much more likely to lose their children in infancy. And if you visit one of these villages, you will see a 70-year-old woman sleeping on a hard mud floor, looking after three grandchildren on $4 cash a month. She was emaciated. Her grandchildren were emaciated. There was no ability to get water or soap to clean their clothes. I mean, I don't want to. I mean, there's understandably people push back against what's called poverty porn. I don't want to denigrate people or make them out as victims. I mean, they're proud, magnificent people doing their best. But I think it's important to understand that the levels of poverty in the world, there are 700 million people in the world who cannot at the moment meet their most basic needs. In Africa, there were 180 million people in that situation in 1980. There are 450 million today. And cash, unconditional cash, is the most direct, straightforward way of transforming somebody's life. I mean, it's the one nonprofit that I'm involved in where I'm really happy to put my own money into it, where I really feel the impact of how much difference you make. You just visit those villages, come back 3 months after the money's gone in, and the village is almost unrecognizable. The houses look different, there's livestock in the streets, people are better fed, the kids are back in school. I mean, it is in a very difficult world where it's difficult to find things to be positive about. There's a wonderful power and simplicity to this.
Hmm. Yeah, well, as you say, Give Directly has been a favorite of EA circles for quite some time for these reasons. It's recommended by givewell.org, which, you know, every year does research on the most effective charities. You know, I've commented upon the various PR problems that EA has had of late, you know, the implosion of Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX being the biggest. How has that affected you in any way that you can discern, or is that just depressing but not consequential?
I think it's depressing but not consequential. I think that the bigger problem is that it remains difficult to get people to do work, which I think is radically humble. We're in a world in which a lot of philanthropists want to feel that they're not just contributing money, they want to feel that they've had some brilliant idea. They've invented something that's going to change the world. You know, I don't know, it's a seesaw which also pumps water, or they've worked out that if you give chickens
to people, play pump.
Exactly. Giving cash is an act of radical humility. It's saying that the community knows more than I know, can do more than I can do, and that the most useful thing I can do for somebody is to give them cash, because a dollar to them is like $100 to me. And to really let people see that and understand that, you have to encourage people to visit the field, to see the extraordinary impact that it has, to hear those testimonies.
Well, we will put a link to Give Directly in the show notes and where we communicate about this podcast. But give it here. What is the URL for the org?
www.givedirectly.org.
Fantastic. Well, Rory, it's great to get you here. I love what you're doing and what you've been doing. It's a Richard Burton-esque adventure without some of the questionable ethics. It's really wonderful. So please keep it up, and I hope to speak to you again whether or not the world further unravels along the lines we both fear.
Well, thank you, Sam, and thank you again for your book on lying, which I thought meant a lot to me.